Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here's your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Dr. Frank Rossi at Cornell University on Twitter at FSR3. And also we have a program Twitter at Cornell Turfgrass. And of course, right now you're on the TurfNet Radio Network. Each episode of Frankly Speaking, I strive to find leading thinkers in the golf turf industry and allied industries, and then I do my best to have a smart conversation, asking the questions you might ask, highlighting progressive practices and philosophies. And we're actually considering an opportunity for people to start sending emails, and we bring guests back, and we have a little bit of a Q&A with emails that get sent in. But for now, that interesting conversation in highlighting progressive practices and philosophies will happen today with Dan Dinelli. Dan is the longtime golf course superintendent in Chicago at the North Shore Country Club in Glenview, Illinois. And anybody that's in this business knows Dan a fairly long time, if for no other reason of his great honor for the GCSA's Presidential Award for Environmental Stewardship. One of the things that I'm certainly most proud of him for achieving, and is really just a small recognition in a long time commitment to the health and well-being of the scientific part of this industry. The thing I've always liked about Dan, and I'm going to embarrass him before we bring him on, is his sort of willingness to always meet the membership's demands and needs, trying to provide the best golf course for them all the time, but thinking outside the box, or not even knowing there is a box, with different goals and objectives in mind that might have more longer term results, sometimes things that are harder to measure in shorter term. And so Dan's embarked on a number of research projects over the years, and I would almost call him my longtime colleague of many years, much like an academic colleague because of Dan's work in doing research. And really, as a measure of that, I was out at the Midwest Association of Golf Course Superintendents last December. And at that meeting, we were talking about the renovations and recoveries, you know, the regrassings that have occurred in Chicagoland over the last several years, and lots of great speakers. And we had a panel discussion, and invariably in that conversation, the question came up about what bent grass are you going to choose? And almost to a person, every one of them said, well, I went and visited Dan at the plots and we talked about the bent grass, and they gave me suggestions. And almost everyone, Dan's impact in the Chicagoland area and certainly in the broader industry, if for nothing else but bent grass selection, I would say has been really important. That's going to be, of course, part of our conversation today. But after all these years at North Shore Country Club, Dan now had the chance recently to prepare for a senior event. Dan hosted a senior PGA event for a number of years, really highlighting his skill, not just that a golf course could be environmentally responsible, a partner to the Environmental Institute for Golf, a certified cooperative sanctuary from Audubon, but also could host a major professional golf tournament that I can recall the standards being commented on being very high. So, of course, Dan knows what he's doing. He's been at it quite a while. And just recently, the move was made at North Shore that they're going to be rebuilding these old POA putting surfaces that I think many would agree, and many that have this experience would agree, that sometimes these things no longer can meet the demands in a sustainable fashion for what we're trying to put them through. So with that long-winded introduction, my friend Dan Dinelli, welcome to Frankly Speaking. Why don't we start, Dan, with how long you've been at North Shore? I know this is you're in the family business. So let's start out with just a few minutes. Dan, welcome to the program, and tell me what it's like growing up on a golf course.
Well, thank you, Frank. That was you can catch your breath now, I hope. But the yeah, I was fortunate to be born in this industry. You know, I have two girls, two daughters that are kind of going through their college thing now and deciding what to do as a profession in their livelihood. And I guess I lucked out. I never really second-guessed it. My grandfather was a superintendent at Northmore and retired there, and the club adopted my grandparents both, allowed them to stay on the grounds there rent-free until they both passed away, and made them an honorary member. So Frank was a wonderful man, and that was back in the Purdue days, Bill Daniel days, and he had three sons, Jimmy, Jerry, And Jerry has a son, JD, who works side by side with me at North Shore Country Club, and then my dad, Joe. And Joe started North Shore Country Club in 1960, the year I was born. And so, to your point, I grew up off the 15th hole, going to sleep every night with the sounds of the old impact heads, because it was center row, you know, manual systems with the old, you know, quick coupler system and the tick, sound that kind of put you to sleep, you know, put you to sleep. So, yeah, I've been here all my life.
And you and JD are still at it. He's still on the crew there with you.
Oh yeah. Our same team, Juan Villarreal, the Ocampos. I got a wonderful team that we've all been here for over 30 years. It's just,
well,
I got a wonderful,
you know,
core group.
Yeah. And that certainly has to, you would say, be a key to your success. Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part, you know, between that and teaming up with researchers is part of the reason I can, you know, indulge some time into trying to figure some of these things out under our conditions, if you want to call it science or whatever. But yeah, we're pretty efficient at what we do, fortunately, and it allows us to kind of expand.
Okay, Dan. Yeah, so you have grown up on it, I would imagine, and a lot of people that have been doing it a very long time would consider it second nature. But it's not like you're preparing a goat track every day. That's a pretty high-end golf club on the North Shore of Chicago. It's I like your aw shucks sort of approach to it, but I will say, having been on that property many a times, it rivals any country club I would ever have been on both in aesthetic and playing performance. So, you know, I want to make sure everybody understands, well, this isn't just a sort of mom and pop operation you're working on here. The expectations are high, which I always thought made a lot of your research more impactful, because, you know, it's one thing when you do work, Dan, and you're playing around with all the compost you've put on those fairways over the years, and it's another thing if they're full of crabgrass and dandelion, right? I mean, compost can work pretty good, maybe if you don't worry about some of the problems it could or couldn't create, and I'm not suggesting it does create problems, but you also had a very high bar. You had to get a lot of your ideas over, right?
Well, they have to be successful like everyone's, and it has to meet our, you know, our financial goals and our overall playing conditions and the agronomics behind it. But, you know, my dad always told me, Danny, this is not your golf course. You don't own it, so you don't go out and experiment on your 18 greens. So I don't want anyone to be led to believe that we're doing, you know, odd stuff to our 18 putting greens. But we're fortunate to have quite a bit of nursery material around us and have built several different red zone studies to USGA specifications, including a 7,000 square foot short game NTEP trial. So even though we team up with a lot of people like Kayla Perdue, I mean, you have influenced us heavily, of course. Michael Bame at Ohio, I was wonderful working with him back when he was in
his
trade.
You know, Mike is the vice provost of the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He is almost second in charge of the whole University of Nebraska system.
Not only is Mike a wonderful man, but he is just my go-to guy back in the day, trying to learn what I can about microbiology. Him and Eric
right,
Nelson,
and then, you know,
who, you know, works with you.
It's funny because, it's funny because Bame and Eric Nelson, my pal here at Cornell, all came out of Harry Hoytink's lab.
Yep.
At Ohio State.
Ohio.
Right?
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. So listen, we're wandering afield here, and I want to get back to, you know, what's going on there currently. So you have been given approval now to reconstruct the greens. Let's get the first of all, those are the same greens that put you to bed with those sprinkler heads every night from the 60s. Yes.
Yes, they were built 1924. A few of them have been resurfaced, but none of them really rebuilt entirely. So they're all push-up type style with several inches of sand top dressing built on the surface, like most old push-up greens. But what's kind of unique, you know, I was able, for pennies on the dollar, I was able to get the government in here and do the official soil analysis done, you know, the soil mapping, because we were in a data gap for the state. And they did a great job, and I learned a lot from their report. But at the end of the day, being close to Lake Michigan and having the glaciers come through here 10,000 years ago, you know, it kind of deposits different types of material as it's basically melting away. So most of our land here is kind of a glacial till, but I actually have one pocket that used to be shoreline of Lake Michigan. They called it Lake Chicago back then. Not that anyone was alive, but for whatever reason, it's Lake Chicago on the old documents. So I do have a corner that's kind of gravelly, sandy. The rest of it was really a wet mesic prairie. And so those soils are pretty boggy, and a lot of sedges and things like that would grow in here naturally. So when they built these greens, you know, rumor has it back in the day, they used to actually select soil types that would hold water because that's pre-irrigation. And so at the end of the day, my greens just drain horribly. And we tried XGD, and it helps us drop the low, you know, the water to high water table. But now when we try to firm things up, you know, it's all about firmness now. It used to be green speed. Now it's about firmness. So when we do that, those lines would light up on us. It's just too different of a soil type with the backfill we use that allows the water to get to the drain lines versus what's embedded around it. And that mucky black soil I have wicks those trenches dry. And so,
so I don't think, I mean, we can go into the details of these things, but I really want to get to the, as you said before we came on live, was the fun part of this conversation. And to do that, I'm going to have to keep interrupting you every once in a while because you and I know if we start ranting, it happens like I started the show. I just keep talking for 10 minutes and we're not interacting as much as we would. So here's the next point. And I want you to decide how you want to answer this, but I know firsthand. Being a friend of yours, not just a colleague, but a friend of yours for a while, and having the chance to visit you a lot over the last several years with my trips to Chicago, I know that you convincing the membership from these 1924 greens through the XGDs to make the move to reconstruct was not easy. So I want, if you could, not to go into the whole process because I know it was a difficult one for you, but what do you think ultimately was the tipping point that got the membership comfortable with ultimately deciding to embark upon this reconstruction plan, which will begin when?
Next June, right after Father's Day, June 19th.
Okay, so what's the tipping point?
Well, the tipping point, you know, we had Paul Vermillion. He was my USGA agronomist and then my PGA agronomist, and we hosted the PGA senior event here. Right. So Paul knows this place extremely well. He's very he's very good at what he does, and he presents the information well. And so we asked Paul to come in and give a few presentations. Of course, we documented everything we could left and right, but I think at the end of the day, what they realized was that even though there are times they were very satisfied with the putting greens, they came to realize that we can have more of those types of days on any given season. So for consistency, firmness, and sustainability, it took a while, but it finally sank in order to be competitive and to minimize the risks. You know, we just came off a couple of years ago with a winter kill issue with the Poania. So, I mean, the first goal that they realized was getting rid of the Poania and the value in that. So then if we're going to get rid of the Poania, what are we going to have to do to the environment to make the bench successful? Well, obviously that means getting rid of some trees and making sure it's on a draining, well-draining root zone. So that's how we kind of got to the end game, starting with the fact that Poa is weak compared to the bent, and what's it going to take to successfully grow these new cultivars?
Okay, so this is very funny, right? Because here you are, as I said in the intro, the guy everybody goes to ask about what's the right bentgrass, and you, the poor guy who does this work, and you're like the shoemaker whose own shoes aren't so good, right? You got these beautiful bentgrass greens you put out there for everybody to research, right? Right? And then everybody else is planting bentgrass greens around you. And so you would say, number one, you're probably, and we're going to get to the below ground part, but I want to start with the above ground part, and that is the bentgrass. I mean, you're making those choices because, you know, Poa isn't a reliable surface, that the challenges that it creates for you and the, you know, the growing environments have to be modified to make what you're going to plant in there more successful. I want to talk about you know, developing reliable, firm, POA-free surfaces, right? And, of course, that begins with choosing the best genetics, right? You and I had some conversations about this, right? So here's the first point of conversation, right? Everybody in Chicago has been looking at your plots when they want to make a choice. But you've been looking at those plots, some of them for, I don't know, close to 20 years now, I bet, right?
Yep, 19, yep.
Yeah, so you've got a pretty good idea.
So what I tell people is Yeah, I mean, yeah, I've been able to live with a lot of them, fortunately. And, you know, with the help of Tom, obviously. Tom's the one who manages the – we have three official NTEP trials here. One 19 years old, one 8 years old.
Tom Boyd at U of I. Yes, Tom Boyd, who we love. We love Tom Boyd.
And, you know – yep, and then Bruce, you know, and Randy Kane, Bruce Brand.
Right, and we love all
Randy
those guys.
Kane.
Randy's a blueberry farmer in Maine. He's tweeting
I know, he
up
failed
out
on
there.
Us. And Derek Settle when he was at the CDGA, you know, so they've all had their hand in the pie here doing various testing and testing POA competitiveness and whatnot. So at the end of the day, the thing I try to say to people is the good news is we probably have a good half a dozen or even more bent grasses to choose from that you'd probably be hard-pressed to tell from one green to another. And the bad news is you got a good half a dozen of bent grass varieties to choose from that you probably wouldn't know the difference from one green to another. So, you know, we're lucky that the plant breeders have done a great job over the last 20 years developing bent grass varieties that not only play well but are sustainable, that are dollar spot, you know, resistant heat resistant. And so we're trying to dig deeper now. So since we have a good handful to choose from, we're now looking at what kind of organic matter do they generate, how they tolerate verticutting.
No. You're not taking me underground yet. You're not taking me underground yet.
Okay,
we're going to stay with the grasses because I'm getting back you know, this show will ultimately go live. We're going to tape right now, and I just came back from the Tri-Societies meeting out in Phoenix, where one of the great joys and you know that you get to have is just networking with your colleagues, that you read their work and you watch their graduate students. And you know, I had the pleasure of having, you know, wonderful 10, 15, 20 minute conversations with, you know, Scott McElroy and Bing-Fu Wong and John Inguijato and Bruce Clark. And one of my favorites was Stacy Bonos. So I got to get 20 minutes with her. And I don't want to say, because I wouldn't criticize my breeding colleagues, because I think they've done a really good job. But one of the things I'd really like in bentgrass cultivars is aggressive spring growth. And I think I saw in an email conversation you had with Leah Brillman, another spectacular plant breeder in the West.
Yes.
That conversation, she made a very telling statement. We have to have bent grasses that can grow when the POA is growing, because if it's not, the POA gets a competitive advantage. So before we get into the details of actually selecting, and, you know, I know you said they've done a good job. I would agree. They can get by with less water. They can get by with less nutrients. I think Doug Soldat presented a paper at the, you know, a frequent guest of this program presented a paper basically saying that he's not sure, except for a few little bit in the summertime, potassium, that you'd ever need to make a potassium application to bent grass. It's mostly a nitrogen management issue for the most part. So much so, he was saying that we're taking off more potassium from the clippings than any soil test indicates we have in the soil. So,
are you getting sidetracked, Frank?
I don't want to get you sidetracked. So here's the question.
Okay.
Do you really feel like we have bent grasses that can meet the needs of a golf course in Chicago that wants to play golf in April and May on those putting surfaces?
Absolutely. I mean, they're not going to come out of the chute as aggressively as Poania does. It's a different animal. But, you know, I get a little confused, Frank, on what is considered spring biological activity or cool weather activity versus just color. And I think often what we get is data sets that reflect just its genetic color.
Yeah, spring
really,
color.
Yeah, over growth. I don't, you know, I
right.
think
we
there's
need
a
vigor.
Difference there.
We need vigor.
We need
vigor.
Exactly. So Rutgers has got information out there. Kale, you know, he's a little farther south than me, but Kale at Purdue's got awesome. He's got an awesome document on various things, including that. And of course, we have our own data set here. So I feel like I've got a little bit of a handle on that under our conditions, because to your point, our springs have been so long and it's cold, damp, you know, cloudy.
Yeah.
That's another thing. Is almost shade tolerance, to the point that we can have overcast skies for quite some time. And as you know, bentgrass, it wants that sun. Poania can take that. But so it's never going to be as competitive as Poania, I think, the varieties that we have at hand now early on. But I think there's varieties out there that's competitive enough that you can allow early play and not cause trouble. And, you know, I'm gonna have to relearn my instincts. You know, I'm used to going out there right away.
That's
and
right.
Top dressing and all that.
That's right. Right. And that's a fair point. And listen, I want to go to a break, a message to our sponsors. But before we go, I want you to give me some idea of are you going with this is, you know, I want you to give me a minute answer on this. Not a very long answer. I want you to give me a minute. I'm going to push you for a minute answer on this. So how many bent grasses are you going to put out there? Are you going to go single selection or are you going to blend? And just in simple terms, what is the philosophy you're using in blending? Is it simply the five best from your trials, or are you picking them for different aspects that might be useful together? So talk for us a minute about how you're going about it. Is it a single variety or blends?
Well, that's a great debate to have because everybody knows bent grass is cross-pollinated. So technically, in each bag, there's a variance. You know, they all segregate to some degree. So unlike bluegrass, you know, there is already some degree of variation within even a cultivar. But that being said, I'm still kind of a blender guy, even though I recognize you know the debate. And so I'll probably pick three. And the reason being is for that diversity, because kind of to your point, we really don't know all these nuances in great detail. Mm-hmm. So if one variety is slightly better at wear or because I got some unique plans on how I'm going to manage these new greens and wear is going to be one of them. And so we've been trying to test that as well. So if one of these varieties have a slight edge over another under different conditions, then I want to be able to take advantage of that. Plus, this might sound a little weird, but being at an old classic golf course like this, I want people to walk off the greens and say, these are nice greens, not necessarily say, boy, these are nice new greens. Now, so what I'm kind of getting to is the patina. Now, you know, many of these grasses, like I said, will segregate and develop that patina over time, but I still want to kind of have a little say in the design of what that patina might look like.
Perfect.
And obviously not be radical.
I'm laughing because I'm still getting over the word patina. I'm searching the web as we're talking. What the hell is that? And
am I going to get myself in trouble if I say names? We probably
we're not going to talk about names yet.
Wonderful variety out there that probably everybody walks to on these NTEP trials. It's just knocks your socks off visually. It's a great putting surface. In my opinion, it creates too much biomass at the surface. It acts as a filter. You can't get sand in it. But that grass, those greens will always look new. It doesn't segregate hardly at all.
So is that
over 8 years.
Is that A4?
No. No.
Okay. So there's pure distinction.
I thought we weren't named. Yeah.
I'm going to name names. You don't have to name them.
All right. Okay. Yeah. It's pure distinction. I mean, that's, you know,
pure distinction
what I typically
is the one
do
that
when
looks
people
pure.
Come here. Oh, it's own grass. It almost looks like moss. But I think
I'm
scared of it. I think it's problematic over time. You know, these fine, there's got to be that sweet spot that when you get such a shoot density as some of these are getting to, especially pure distinction, it acts as a filter. So even if you try to put a coarse sand down, if you're not dimpling it first or opening it up somehow, that verdure, the courses are going to float. And the worst thing you can have is a combination of high organic matter teamed with fine sands. It's all about the pores, right? So the porosity of that mix will just go to hell, and that red zone will turn upside down on you real quick and have potential issues. So managing that grass is going to be tricky.
That's right. And so you keep wanting to go underground. And so we're going to take a break. And I'm not going to let you go underground for a few more minutes when we get back from our break. Dan Dinelli, everybody, the golf course superintendent, North Shore Country Club, my longtime colleague. We are just getting started here on Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot, 22 tons per acre, and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Best of all, Maximus by Dryject is only half the cost of alternative deep aeration and fill technologies. Visit MaximusAeration.com to locate your nearest Maximus by Dryject service center.
It's a fact. UVB and infrared radiation are harmful to plant health and can actually damage a plant's ability to photosynthesize properly. Turf Screen is the only product independently verified to reduce the damaging effects of solar radiation and to significantly improve turf quality, density, and health. Decrease water usage, turf stress, and wilt. Increase chlorophyll and photosynthesis. Don't be fooled by ordinary dark pigments. Give your fine turf a leg up on summer stress with Turf Screen. For research data, application information, and to find your nearest distributor, visit turfscreen.com.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm chatting today with the golf course superintendent at North Shore Country Club, Glenview, Illinois. My pal Dan Donnelly grew up listening to sprinkler head, impact heads at night, serenading him to bed. And they are now about to rebuild the greens at North Shore Country Club. We have wandered into the bent grass discussion, and I've been doing the best I can to keep them above ground. And the last question I'm going to ask you is above ground before we go below ground, Dan, is the comment that you made before we went to the break about when, you know, how everybody's drawn to pure distinction because of its purity. You've talked about its density. It seems to be a favorite of yours as well, but you also said there's a downside to it. Now, before we get to the downsides, what I have heard you say in the past, and I think I've actually seen data about it, is the correlation you've seen with the amount of segregation or modeling that occurs with a bent grass. And that's correlation to POA suppression. You found that the ones that segregate the most tend to be the ones that are the best at keeping the POA out. So a couple of minutes on that concept.
Well, that's just an observation, Frank. I couldn't even think about how to explain that, you know, biologically. But it seems that the ones that are that stay true, that don't segregate. I don't even know if staying true is the right word, but that at the end of the day, the ones that segregate the most are the ones that tend to have the most poania. But obviously, shoot density, I'm sure, plays a role in that, and as well as, you know, cultural.
So
practices.
I got it backwards. Wait, let's make sure we got this right. The more it segregates, the more POA you've seen.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. I thought I had it backwards. I thought segregation was actually less POA, but just to clarify, the more segregated varieties are the ones that have typically had the most POA. Now, your data is in the public domain, so what varieties are those that have struggled the most with segregation?
Well, Pencross is the flagship for that.
Okay. More recent varieties. Are there newer ones that are segregating too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, right now is the time of the year to go look. I don't have that data set in front of me, but it's on the NTEP. Tom has taken
right.
that
so,
information.
So that data is publicly available for people to see what you've observed. So, you know, we don't have to worry about mentioning names because much of this data is in the public domain. So to get to where I know you want to get to, you're going to blend three of them. I'm assuming you're going to pick three of the best ones, correct?
Well, yeah, I hope so, of course.
Well, so now
the,
I'm going
to
challenge you
how
right
you
off
define
the bat.
The best, you know?
All right,
how
well,
you define the best.
I want you to define the best. So tell me what is the criteria under which you're going to put these bent grasses, the bent grass selection through? What are you picking?
Well, this
Now's
winter, we collect. Okay, so this summer, we really was anal in collecting a lot of information that's not widely available. You know, we bought one of those Sphero toys, for example, and tried to get our arms around surface firmness. I don't mean soil firmness. We've got tools that effectively pick that up. But if you take your fingertips to these cultivars and you just gently push the ground, you'll feel some are much softer than others because of the surface biomass. So
almost
moss-like,
right? So dense, it's holding moisture up at the surface.
Right, Right, right. And all those thumper machines don't pick up on that. So we tried the Sphero and tried the hot mode and collected data. So we're going to decipher that this winter, because the two extremes is Pencross being the firmest, Pure Distinction being the softest. And if it's all about firmness, then that means you're going to have to be really aggressive at mowing heights just to get that biomass down to a level that it's not so spongy at the top. So that's one. But the other one that I'm really trying to dial in on are two others. One is organic matter. We've got several data sets of organic matter. If you can visualize having the same green managed exactly the same, we have a wonderful opportunity to get loss on ignition values on these different varieties replicated and come up with good numbers.
Over 20 years.
So that's a very important one, and we'll get to that because that's going to bring us underground. And the one that's the most recent is we're aggressively verticutting them, because I'm convinced that the more sand we put down, the more biomass, the more organic matter we develop. And I know that's counterintuitive and to what we're led to think, because obviously wherever you deposit that sand is going to dilute the organic matter that's there. But if we look at a plant and divide it into three zones, let's take the top zone, the aerial zone, we'll call that the leaf tissue. The bottom zone would be the fibrous fine roots. And the middle zone would be the soil level where we have the high lignin cellulose-like material, the stolons, the crowns, the stems, and the nodes. And these more
bulky. The stuff that we have
bulky,
to dilute. The stuff that we have to dilute.
Yes. So let me ask you, Frank. You go out there and you put a layer of sand down. What happens? How does that plant respond to that layer of sand? That fresh, clean layer of sand, you just diluted that specific zone of organic matter. So then how does the plant respond to that?
Well, if you're gonna ask me this question, I'm gonna be the guest for a minute, and here's what I'm gonna tell you. I'm gonna tell you that the chasing the tail part of this thing, of the sand leading to more growth, needing more sand, leading to more growth,
yep,
needing more sand.
Yep.
There's two components to that. One is there could be some significant nutrient PGR programs that need to be addressed. That's one question on it. But to me, the bigger question is when you aggressively verticut, you thin that sand, and then you incorporate sand into it, and I believe that leads to even more biomass production, and that's the chasing the tail part. I mean, you have to thin it out with the vertical cut or the grooming, right? Let's call it grooming, to make room for the sand. But by doing that, aren't you stimulating more growth by, you know, creating a womb that you put the sand into and then it fills up around, right? So this
is the back and forth. Yeah, that's a great point. I got to put a little plug in. I just posted a couple of videos on YouTube, and it's linked through my LinkedIn page. So if anybody wants to see some of these things as a show and tell. But can we stop? Let's start at a real high level on this discussion now that we're finally there.
Okay,
so
good.
If you talk about grasses to an ecologist, they get excited about grasses because it's early in the plant succession, right? It's a pioneer plant. It kind of goes
first thing that
lichen,
gets in
moss,
there when there's sun,
grass.
When there's light.
Yeah, so if you have a soil disturbance of any kind, grass is one of the earlier grasses to come in. The fibrous roots anchors the loose soil that's around there, whether it's a landslide, a fire, whatever. And then the plant's role, the grass's role in nature is to build soil. It's made to deposit this organic matter for the next succession of plants.
That's
so
correct.
If we understand that behavior, then it's no wonder why grasses do pretty good in impoverished systems like our high sand systems, because it's really designed. But what we're finding out is several things. One is plant genetics. Plant genetics, not all plants, not all species, not all cultivars are as good of soil builders as others. And it doesn't necessarily tie into shoot density, surprisingly. So you have a certain amount of this complex carbon material, this carbon allocation within each plant's genetics traits that are better or worse. So we kind of want to ideally select the grasses, if all else is equal, that are really kind of poor at building soils. Because at the end of the day, we're trying to keep a sand system young. We're trying to keep it functioning as though it's still young and keep it from aging.
So let me stop you there. Ho, 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 because that's a mouthful. That was good. and I think I understand it clearly. So let me ask a clarifying question, right? So the clarifying question is this, that you said something that is always in my mind, a constant conversation, that I've noticed in on golf courses I visit that get a lot of traffic, they need top growth, okay? And to keep up with the foot traffic, to keep up with the walk on, walk off, to keep up with where the cup's going to be when we're talking about putting surfaces. And typically, I think we've associated good traffic tolerance and recovery with biomass or top growth. And yet you're saying you want that, but you want one that's not going to build a lot of organic matter below. Do we have grasses now that give us the recuperative potential we need for the function of the putting surfaces without creating that organic matter accumulation situation in that middle zone that we're talking about?
Right. So I want to be clear. Not any one of these things that we're going to wind up talking about in itself is going to probably move the needle enough to be a standalone. So what we're going to talk about has to collectively come together. And plant genetics right now we're talking about. So as an example, if I'm going to just say Cato, according to our data,
right,
is
all
else being equal, yeah, it generated 2.8% organic matter. A4 was 2.2, a hair over 2.2. So to your question, Frank, I think A4 is pretty wear tolerant. It's got a decent shoot density and still a favorable grass. I like A1 better personally, but you, there's just two comparisons for you. What is that? That's almost so shy of a percent difference.
I mean, I'm looking at your data here, Dan, and you got Penn A4, in fact, Penn Cross at one end at about 2.2, and you got Cato and Crenshaw at the other end at about 2.8. So, you know, Cato and Crenshaw are coming out of the Arizona breeding program and that Dr. Engelke then worked on in Texas for a long time. But bentgrasses that were developed under more desert-like conditions, where dollar spot in particular is not a particular problem down there, and Penn Cross and Penn A4 at the other end developed more closely to the climates that you're talking about where you are. And I look at Providence in the middle here at about 2.4%. I think Scogley found that along the coast in an old cemetery along the New England coast when he started with Providence that became the parent material there. So your answer to my question is, we have grasses that give us good wear tolerance with shoot growth, but are not accumulating or excessive organic matter, recognizing that that's not going to solve this problem completely, but in your mind is a selection criteria based on your data.
Correct. That's correct.
All right.
So let me take it one step further, and this is a grayer box yet. All right. This is almost getting it to be a black box, but I'm hoping science picks up on this and researchers look a little different. You know, you got to when you study these things, you kind of have to beg, borrow, and steal from other industries, whether it's the pulp industry, the biofuel industry, because they're trying to figure out ways to easily make pulp out of wood and break down the cellulose material. Obviously, making alcohol and biofuels, the same thing. So you learn about enzymes and different microbes that are responsible. But at the end of the day, it's not only the percent or amount of lignin, hemicellulose, or cellulose the plant generates, but it's also what are the polymers that make up those materials. And so we dug a little deeper with some data and analyzed what impacts different root zone mixes have, for example, how an 85-15 sphagnum peat mix reacts with the same grass, the same genetics, with a 95-5% biochar and 5% composted swine manure. So what we found out was that the mannans, a part that makes up the cellulose, a polymer, was significantly different. So these different polymers actually react differently in the environment, and some create a more persistent organic material than others.
Okay.
You know, when we use the term diluting with sand, I think that's a very fair term. Very little of this stuff cycles out under most of our conditions, and I hope you get to talk about that.
That's what we're going to talk about. All right, hold on. All right, because I gotta, you know, you and I have had this conversation over the last 3 years. People are just listening to this thing. They're like, who are these two idiots, you know, talking about stuff like mannans and polymers that make up hemicellulose and lignaceous material? I want to get to some of the data that you've shared with me, looking at the 19-year evolution of your root zone work. I think that's the best place.
Okay.
Let's dig into that because time's going to be short.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. So what we did this year.
Hold on.
Okay. So what we did this year. Are you ready? Am I jumping ahead?
I want to ask a question. You're not going to. I want to ask a question.
We're going to run out of time.
We're not going to run out of time. We got plenty of time. We got about 12 minutes to do some of this. So hold on. Listen, you're in polymers. We got to get guys to understand, first of all, what you've seen. So let me try to reflect what I've looked at here, and then you clarify. Okay? You've done a bunch of root zone mixes, right? You've put the same grass over a variety of root zone mixes over a 19-year period, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You froze the stuff in the beginning. And then you sampled it. You took another sample and then sampled it so many years later. You looked at upper and lower root zone carbon. In the interest of time, I'm just going to look at upper organic matter accumulation. Okay? Which is a measure of the organic matter that's accumulated at the surface, because very little organic matter has accumulated at the lower end. Now, just don't start giving me a lot of answers yet. Where's the line between lower and upper in your sampling?
All right. So when we built this green, to your
No. You have to answer the question. What's the line between lower and upper?
Well, the lower is the original 12-inch ridge zone mix. So that's the lower.
Okay.
12-inch.
So originally, in a lot of these mixes, in the sand-based mixes, the USGA sands, straight sands, right?
Yep. I've got 20 different ridge zone cells in there. The same sand, but one straight sand, the other with reed sedge, the other one with sphagnum, one with Zea Pro Axis. So I've got inorganic and organic amendments represented within 20. 20,
all those
20-year 20
studies. Okay, so here's what I've seen in the data. Here's what I've seen in the data. I'm looking at your compost and biosolid data. And what it looks like over a 20-year period, is composted biosolids in these mixtures, right? Composted biosolids, just the composted biosolids in this mixture. Essentially, more organic matter to start. You're starting at about a 1%, 1.7% organic matter level. And at the lower level, it declines. But at the upper level, it increases. But where compared to the straight sand, the compost and biosolid root mixes are increasing about twofold in organic matter at the surface.
All right, let me try. Let me try to explain it, Frank.
And
see if it works, because you're confusing me.
Wait. No, you got straight sand. Organic matter increased between 5 and 7.5% at the surface.
Yeah, you're confusing me. Let me tell the story. Okay, so basically what we did is what you explained, which is we 19 years ago we built this green with 20 different red zone mixes, and with the same plant genetics, a 50-50 blend of L93 and Providence, all managed the same, exactly the same, same environment, everything. So what we did is we kept a baggie of these original mixes dry, sealed up in my attic in the shop. This spring, we took that out. We did three different tests, three different samplings. One was the original parent material preserved up in the bag. Second was the original 12-inch mix. So we'll call that the original mix that's been aged or weathered out in the field for 19 years, the original 12-inch. We took a third set of samples, which is that top 4 inches that grew on top of the original 12. We call that the top dressing thatch horizon. And what we discovered
in 20 years, you added 4 inches.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Just through straight sand top dressing.
Perfect.
Straight sand
top.
I did not, we stuck with the same sand top, straight sand. So that being said, what we learned was in the straight sand root zone, this clean sand, the original 12 inches, obviously started with nothing, no organic matter. And that did grow into 0.26%, a little more than 0.25% of organic matter. So it's true that you do deposit some organic matter over time, whether it's the humates you put down, the roots that die and cycle back, whatever. But it's only 0.26, okay?
It's
so that's
low.
The straight sand. Very low. So let's look at an industry standard of sphagnum peat. That the original mix started out at almost 1%. Over 19 years, we lost with the sphagnum peat 44%. So that dropped down to a little over 0.5% of organic matter. Follow me? So net-net, we ended up at 0.54. So you have to assume we had some deposit taking place, but we lost more peat than the deposit, and it ended up at 0.54 from 0.9. So we have an original root zone mix that's leaning out over time. And the reed sedge was more stable. We lost 23% in that case. That went from 0.94 to 0.72. So that was a little more stable organic matter. And surprisingly, shocking, we did a 90-10, right?
The compost biosolids?
Yeah. Is there a percent on here? It's an 85-15. And that was a 50-50 blend of yard waste compost with biosolids. Surprisingly, we only lost 19%. I thought that would be more active with more mineralization. But at the end of the day, what I learned was that organic matter that you originally start with in a sand, high sand green leans out over time, even given the deposit that's taken place under our management. Now, let's look at that top 4 inches. This is where the disconnect is. From the seed bed up, that was testing out consistently over, didn't matter what root zone was underneath, no biology differential, nothing. That all tested out to be a
2.15.
Yeah, so you have a 4-inch cap of organic matter that's significantly different, and it's an abrupt change. There's not a graceful transition that I assumed was happening. When you build a new green and you see those massive roots, it's just a huge mass of roots. You just love them for the first couple of years. You are assuming that all those fine roots are dying and just contributing, and you get this graceful buildup of organic matter mixed with sand that has some kind of... it's a sharp cut. You can draw a line where this change is at that seedbed.
But the answer to your question is they do that, but they do it only in the top 4 inches. Once that seedbed's there and you start growing and you start updrafting, you're basically leaving the root zone you installed there behind.
Yep.
Based on your data, that stuff remains unchanged.
So ask me,
Frank,
where are my roots? Ask me where my roots are today on that 19-year-old green.
They're all in the top 4 inches.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what I built the green out of. Nothing. The profile that's persistent doesn't change. Axis, Zia Pro, it didn't matter. Every single root zone mix out there, it's all in that top 4 inches. It makes driving me nuts.
I know. So since we're talking about driving you nuts, I got to go to another message from our sponsors, Dan, and I'm going to do that really quickly. And when we come back, we're going to have about 5 minutes for you to give me what it is you're designing for the root zone below. Boys and girls, Dan Dinelli, the golf course superintendent at North Shore Country Club, my pal for a really long time, putting up with me, trying to navigate the way through root zone chemistry. We'll be right back on Frankly Speaking.
Golf course superintendents all agree. Traditional core aeration is time-consuming, labor-intensive, and unpopular with golfers. Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water infiltration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and immediately playable. Best of all, an independent Dryject service professional does it for you, there and gone before you know it. Dryject. The only process in the world that aerates, top dresses, and amends in one pass. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking, my pal Dan Donnelly, the golf course superintendent at North Shore Country Club, Glenville, Illinois. I think we're pretty close to click and clack about cars, Dan, talking about stupid roof zone stuff. So tell me now, in the last 5 minutes, as we try to wrap up this epic episode of Frankly Speaking, what is the philosophy with what you've just said as a backdrop about the disconnect we're having between throwing more sand seems to lean to more organic matter. Building things out of sand and organic matter leans out over time. The plants continue to grow in an impoverished environment and seem to only be interested in improving what you keep putting into them, which is the sand that you're top dressing with. So with that as a backdrop and you having to rebuild 18 greens, what's the philosophy that you're using in designing your root zone?
Well, the philosophy is if we understand that the original mix is going to lean out and what you do at the surface is going to richen up and act as a biofilter, basically, and trap the nutrients and the moisture and ultimately end up with an upside down root zone where the roots are going to grow primarily in that top dressing horizon. The challenge then is two. One is, what are you going to do in construction to try to mitigate that? The other challenge is how we're going to manage the from the grow in on as the green matures. Those are the two areas. And I'm not going to claim I've got the answers for these things, but the things that we've been experimenting with both in our greenhouse and out in the field for the last couple of years is biochar. We're trying to get biochar, which is a type of organic matter, charcoal-like material that has a tremendously high CEC. It's got great porosity depending on the parent material, the feedstock it's made from, that will trap the moisture in the air, and it creates a wonderful habitat for biology. So we're trying to get biochar as part of the original mix because it's not going to lean out like other organic materials. It's persistent. It's been like graphite-like. So that's our one answer for the mix in part.
So just so people understand, biochar. Just so people understand for a second, biochar is generally, its feedstock is organic material, which can range all the ranges of organic material. And I think I've heard people say that depending on the source of the biochar could impact how it performs. But for your purposes, it is a stable form of organic matter that in 10,000, 20,000 years is a lot closer to becoming a fossil fuel than the roots at the bottom of a bentgrass plant, right? It's an advanced, more advanced, stable form of carbon that won't lean out and provide a habitat for microorganisms. I'm not sure you have an idea of what those microorganisms are, but I'm assuming it's organic matter digesting microorganisms. Is that a correct assumption?
What you're reflecting on is our one of our top dressing studies. We're trying to use biochar with some of the fungi that's got the right enzymes, the cellulase, to break down the cellulose. That's different. The pre-construction, I'm more interested in what microbes are going to contribute to the rhizosphere and in a healthy phytobiome, which is one of words today that's catching a lot of attention. So we're more interested in pre-construction on trying to jumpstart the biology with the known good guys, the various bacilluses, pseudomonases, trichodermas, even mycorrhizae.
Why jumpstart?
Well, because there's a philosophy out there that the first of the table gets served. And what that means is once a system gets established and, for a lack of better words, stabilizes or matures would probably be the best word, to introduce organisms that it becomes more complicated. So if you can overwhelm a system that's got a void to it, a vacuum, if you will, with known good guys, and a lot of the guys that we're going to use are things from extracts that we don't even know. But at the end of the day, is if we can outcompete the pathogens and perhaps even the plant parasitic nematodes, and offer a healthier rhizosphere, then that plant will, in theory, be more sustainable when stresses.
And furthermore, but the original question, Dan, and we got a couple of minutes here, pal. But so let's say you build these root zones out of this stuff that really is magic. Are you going to top dress with this stuff?
Dad, I don't think so. My plan in top dressing is actually to almost omit top dressing. Experimenting with different tools to recycle the existing sand that's there.
That's not disruptive?
Absolutely. So what we've done this whole summer is test these plots on the tolerance of this practice of micro little coirifying tool that's on that video that that I'm going to take advantage of, and a certain type of verticutting machine. The nickname's a
pole
buster.
So your plan is to do the poor man's top dressing like they do on sports fields, bringing up sand and then just spreading it around rather than a very light blanket.
Right, and then the physical removal of biomass during that process is part of it. And at the end of the day, the golfer won't even know the next day. So Frank, all right, look, this is the way I kind of generalize it. As an industry, you and I have been around long enough. We've seen how practices kind of come in. What we tend to do as an industry is grab onto something and hit it hard. Mm-hmm. And then what we learn over time is what often works better is light and frequent, whether it's fertilizing, whether it's growth regulating, top dressing even. So the same philosophy with our cultivation, I think we need to evolve to that next step. We tend to go in there heavy in the fall, maybe in the spring. If you're lucky, maybe once in the summer if you can get away with it. But generally, we go in there with a very aggressive procedure, do it infrequently. In the end,
You're talking about coring, not top dressing.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'm talking about coring in general.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? And we got to wrap this up, pal. But I got to tell you, this is the complete opposite end of a conversation I had with Chris Tritabaugh and his greens at the Hazeltine Golf Club and what he's doing up there with his bent grasses. So this is the wonderful part about doing this show and having my job talking to my good pals like you. I don't think this conversation is over, but I'm going to give you 30 seconds for the last word, pal. 30 seconds.
Well, I'm convinced that sand top dressing actually increases organic matter over time. And if you really study how
rate.
Well, you tend to match your aggressive you tend to match your aggressiveness of top dressing with your growth rate. So at the end of the day, I don't think we've finished that. So the area that we are impacting with a top dressing treatment is near the surface, and that plant responds by growing through and stretching through that sand, causing us to reapply the sand. And that area, those plant parts that generally are doing that, are the parts that are high in lignin and cellulose. It's not the leaf tissue. It's not the fine roots that will degrade. So the more sand we put down, the more the plant responds and grows through it, and the more we are left with the high lignin cellulose that's simply diluted and not cycled at a very high rate at all. And ultimately, we lose that battle, and then we go in there and aggressively core, drill and fill, and grade.
Gotta go.
And lose it.
Dan Dinelli, North Shore Country Club, my pal and longtime friend. Thanks for joining us on Frankly Speaking.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.